succession number 27083, Reel 31.
Than fighting for its own thing, rather. And I can't remember what the subject was, but they were arguing ad nauseam over something.
So Henry, the scientists were arguing.
They couldn't make their minds up whether to go for this or go for that. And I was supposed to be chairing this meeting. And I was also supposed to be attending the christening of the young daughter of a great friend of mine who had in fact been the direction officer with me in Newcastle. And although I tried to wriggle out of this, I had failed. And I decided that there was only one solution, and that was to let this lot go on arguing while I attended the christening, which was in the afternoon. And I handed over to my deputy and said, you take the chair. I will be back at 4:30, or whatever it was. And left. Went to the christening. Just managed to have my cup of tea and a slice of cake. Returned to ASRE, and of course they were still undecided and arguing with us. So I summed up the way I wanted the meeting to go. That ended the meeting, and that was that. And there it was. Then the captain left, Martel left, to go and drive, I think it was the Salam, a colony class cruiser. I'm one of the few left by Duncan Sands, who was hacking things around a bit. And he was relieved by a man called Hutchins, R.E. Hutchins, who I didn't really know at all. I'd just met. And he was ex-lower deck. He didn't have the talent, he didn't have the expertise, and he didn't have the, certainly didn't have the brains of his predecessor at all. And the first paper I presented to him, can't remember what it was on about, he said in a very sort of loud voice, there are only two bits of punctuation that I understand. One is a comma and the other is a full stop. So I thought, well, okay, you know, but I didn't see why I should redraft my paper just for the sake of that. And I found him quite difficult, but...
Difficult because he wasn't up to the job?
Yeah, really. But still, there it was. And then... the day came when I received... really at virtually no notice at all, a job change, and I had to go to the Admiralty and join the Directorate of Naval Officer Appointments on the seaman side and be the seaman member of the Officer Policy Section. And it was in the run-up to what became Duncan Sands' 57 Acts. And I'm talking now of, I suppose, midsummer, early to midsummer of 57. No, of 55. So I left ASRE. And I managed to find digs in Petit France because the personnel side of the Admiralty was then housed in Queen Anne's Mansions, which is now the Home Office, I think. But then it was unmodernized and was very close to my digs and so forth. And I had an excellent turnover from a man who'd been, and was a personal friend, in my long course. But it took 3 weeks, the longest turnover I've ever had in my life. And 1 week was spent on the officer structure, 1 week was spent on promotions, and 1 week was spent on the acts. Well, the officer structure, I knew a certain amount about, of course, but by no means enough, and I had to learn quite a lot. The question of promotions was complete news to me, and I had to grip it fairly hard. This was not selecting individuals for promotion or against it, but it was the numbers game, and you had to get the numbers exactly right. And you had to get the spread of promotions across, say, the rank of lieutenant commander to commander, and again, commander to captain. And beyond that, it was more pin work by the naval secretary. But you had to get the spread right so as to maintain what was technically described as even flow. And the distribution was, in mathematical terms, was Gaussian. That's to say, you started with very few, rose to a crescendo in the middle part of the zone, and then progressively tailed away to end with a very few and finally none. And that was it. And this was important. And you did this for up to 20 years ahead. And there was no, that I ever discovered, and still haven't, there was no empirical formula by which you could get it right. And unless you tried it, you literally sucked it and saw, you might find after 10 years, 15 years even, there was a hiccup and it didn't work out. So you had to get it right, and you had to go on for about 20 years. And as to the acts, I might as well deal with that now, but virtually every officer of, I think it went down to lieutenant commanders, pretty sure it did, a lieutenant commander's rank and commanders and captains was categorized. And they were put in the category of Alpha, Beta Plus, Beta Minus, and Charlie. I'm mixing my languages rather, but that's what they were known as then. And the Charlies were the deadbeats, which might have been at any rank. They're probably at lieutenant commander. And subject only to the preservation of what I've just been talking about, even flow, as far as possible, all the Charlies were to go. And the number of people going was quite considerable. Equally, one would have liked to have kept all the alphas, but that wouldn't do because it would have disrupted the even flow. And so some alphas had to go too, and that led to problems. Again, I'm talking of numbers, not the individuals. Though inevitably, although I didn't select them, the names of individuals were bywords about the department. And so on. Well, the director of this lot was a man called Neville Curry. He was a very senior captain, and he had under him a very good team. He had an aviation, a fairly senior aviation commander with lieutenant commanders under him, to deal with the aviators, and he had a seaman commander with under him a series of lieutenant commanders dealing with the, by then in force, the general list, the SD list, and the sub-lieutenants. The It was, as I say, a very good team. I was part of it, but whereas they dealt with appointments, I did not. Inevitably, you were aware of appointments and so forth, but they weren't my personal responsibility. I was the theoretician and also the supposedly the maestro for seaman officer policy and so on. Neville Currie, the director, was a very fine man. I'd just met him out in Greece after the war, but he wouldn't have remembered it, and nor did I. And as I mentioned earlier, I had an excellent turnover, and my predecessor then left after 3 weeks and was going to just pop in to see how, if I was happy 1 week later. And Friday of my first week on my own came, and the first thing that I really had to get to grips with was the axe, because the books were going to have to close in November that year, and this was now June, July, so that an Admiralty Fleet order could be issued telling everybody when, as far as they could, when they were going to be released, if they were going to be axed, so that they could discuss this with their families when they went home on Christmas Eve. A very sensible arrangement. And I pored over my predecessor's workings, as I had done the whole week, and I couldn't make them add up. They made no sense to me at all. And I suppose I could have waited until he came in the following week, but I was the one chap that had to defend my corner, as it were, straight up to the Second Sea Lord, who might say, well, why so-and-so, and why not something else? And I had to be able to answer back and say, you can't do that because, and I was the only one in position to do so. So I really had to know it. And I was ground down, making no sense of anything, 3 o'clock or so on that Friday afternoon, when a voice at my shoulder said, very quietly, how are you getting on? And I didn't know who it was, and I didn't bother, and I was very distraught, and I just blurted out, I simply don't know what I'm doing. And I thought, who on earth is that? And I looked over my shoulder, and it was my director, Neville Currie. So, of course, I leapt to my feet and started to apologize. I said, sorry, sir, I didn't know it was you, and that sort of thing. And he gave me a very cold look for a moment. And then his face cracked into a grin, and he said, you're in very good company. And I came clean and said, I'm sorry, sir, I cannot make my predecessor's figures work. And I fed the long playing record. And I realized that I am the one that has to be able to argue the task with the Second Sea Lord and his deputy, and convincing me, for which I've got to know my stuff, for which I've got to have done my sums. And I can only suggest that I stop my leave and work at it until I've done them. And this rather shook him. And he said, well, do you think you can do it in time? I said, well, sir, it's got to be done in time. So, yes, I do. And he said, all right, well, good luck, but keep me in touch. And he left. And I rang up home, and I said, no weekend leave, and not for as far as I can see, which didn't go down too well, but I wasn't married then, and so forth. And I got down to it. And because of the time scale, And because the nature of the work was very largely actuarial, with which I was not familiar. But for example, just to indicate the importance of it, if you like, by this time they had split the list for commanders and captains into wet and dry. You're familiar with that. And if I made an error of 0.25% in what was termed wastage, then 12 wet captains either went to the wall when they shouldn't have done, or didn't go to the wall when they should have done. And it was correspondingly worse at commanders and lieutenant commanders level, and so forth. So it was quite a strain. I very quickly realized that you didn't dare go to your club for lunch, because you would meet people there who you hadn't seen for some time, who said, "Oh, I'm just off to drive so-and-so," and knew by hearsay, although you didn't pick the names, knew perfectly well that they were going to be X and not going to drive so-and-so at all. And it was quite a strain.
I'm just going to ask, can you just give me an idea, just in broad percentage terms, within these middle ranks, lieutenant commander, commander and captain, how many as a percentage of the total of over those three ranks were going to be lost, if I can put it that way?
It varied between the ranks, because there was an overburden of lieutenant commanders. There was something of an overburden of captains and commanders because there were no longer sufficient sea commands, hence the split list, which had helped things a bit, but it hadn't cured it entirely, and so forth. I'm afraid I can't give you a percentage, because I think I might produce a misleading figure. It's too difficult. At this range, but it was very critical. Well, now going on,
Sir Henry, can I just ask this question, which goes back to the four categories of officer? In order to maintain the even flow, why was it necessary to lose a degree, a percentage of alpha officers? I can understand why you'd quite happy to say goodbye to beta minuses and the Charlies.
Because you had to project your thinking right on up. As I've already described, up to and including the rank of captain, your distribution was broadly, indeed fairly accurately, Gaussian, and needed to be. If you had skimmed off, retained all the alphas, by no means all those alphas would have made flag rank, because there weren't vacancies for them. And therefore, you would have unbalanced I can only describe it that way, I think. You would have unbalanced the evenness of the flow. You would have had a hiccup. And that's how it was done.
Right.
I've very nearly done with my time there. Sounds very easy, and it's not taking very long. But actually, it was a very traumatic time. And not only did I stop my weekend leave, but I used to get to my office at 8 o'clock in the morning. I would probably have a sandwich at my desk. I would leave at about 9 o'clock at night, and I would go round the corner to a funny little restaurant there called the Crow's Nest, just round the corner. I would give myself a decent supper, and I would return and work on until 1 2, 3, or 4 in the morning, Saturdays and Sundays included. And it was telling, to say the least. It was particularly telling because you were directly affecting the lives or the welfare of people. And I must confess that by the end I'd had enough of it. I was just about worn out. If anything, I was more worn out, I think, than I had been over the coronation stuff. But there it was. It had to be done. And the day came in November 56 when the books had to be closed and the Admiralty Fleet order had to be sent to the printers and so forth. And that was the end of it, as far as I was concerned, in terms of the Axe planning. I said it was a very good team, and they were, and they very kindly took me, by arrangement, they took me around the corner to the crow's nest, and they said, we're going to feed and drink you to just the right level, and we're going to have you back in your pit, which was only just across the road in Petit France, by 10 o'clock. And they were as good as their word. They did. And I got to my digs, and I tumbled into bed, and I died. And at midnight, I was wide awake, and I couldn't sleep. I wasn't used to it. And it became a matter of some concern to me that I couldn't sleep because I'd trained myself, forced myself not to.
Yes.
And there it was. Well, that had taken the sting out of my job. I still had the promotions and the officer policy and that sort of thing to do, but the Axe was settled. And at about that time, I don't know how it came about. I know how it was. One of my friends in the department brought back from his weekend, brought back a pair of wild duck that he'd shot over the weekend. He was a keen shot. And these were spare, and he handed them to me. And he'd had them. I think he'd shot them on the Saturday, and this would have been, he probably handed them to me on the Monday. By the Monday night when I went to my digs, they were, shall I say, you were beginning to be increasingly conscious of the presence of a pair of wild duck. And by Tuesday morning, I wasn't quite sure what to do with these birds. So on the Monday night, I rang up and thought it was about time, and I was pretty desperate also. I rang up my beloved Mary, who was then living with others in a flat down in Earl's Court. And I asked her if she'd like a pair of wild duck, and it was arranged that she effectively asked me to supper, and I could bring the wild duck, and she would give me supper, and we'd see what. We hadn't actually seen each other for whatever the number of years was, since back in 1949-50, and so on. Well,
and only exchanged Christmas cards.
And only exchanged Christmas cards, really. Yes.
So you were not quite strangers, but almost again, so to speak, or not?
Yes.
Yes.
In my desperation, I had eyed a couple of other girls, one of whom was a waitress in one of the restaurants I used to go to. Charming girl, but I discovered that her parents had divorced, and she led a pretty sort of odd life, I thought. So I didn't fall madly in love with her, but I'd never really fallen madly out of love with Mary. Rather the reverse. Anyway, I had trouble over these wild ducks because in order to keep them in my room, I secured a bit of string around their necks and jammed the sash window down on top of the string. But somehow the odor trickled through, and whoever did my room while I was out at work decided it was time the window was open, and threw the sash up and dropped the pair of wild duck down onto the roof below. And I had some difficulty in fishing them out, but I did. And sure enough, the following night, I took a taxi down to Earl's Court. And it was not a happy trip, because I simply could not take the stench of these birds inside the cab. And so I had to put them outside the cab, and I had to hold on to them with one hand, close the window on my hand, and this was, of course, middle of November or whatever, and it was freezing cold. Anyway, I handed them over, and they were quickly shuffled away out of smell, and so forth. And it was delightful to see Mary again. She hadn't changed a bit, and there we were. And I might as well finish that aspect of my life, because it was really rather important while I started it. We saw each other a bit from time to time, one way or another, and I felt exactly the same about her as I previously had done. What I did not know was whether her feelings towards me had changed or not, but this needed to be tested out. And so there was no point in going on and having another work-up phase, as it were. quite quickly I decided that I must go for it. And I fixed a dinner at Odonino's. And we met, and we had a jolly good dinner, and everything was going swimmingly. And I happened to glance at my watch, and I saw that it was close on midnight, and at midnight they had a cabaret. And I thought, well, I'd better pop the question before the cabaret, because it'll be noisier and all the rest of it. And I pulled myself together and leant across the table and popped the question. And I'd hardly got the words out of my mouth when the band leader or a compere or whoever stepped out in front, and there was a great sort of da-da-da-da-da-da from the band, and somebody was going to come on and sing. And I'd watched Mary fairly closely, and she had replied, but I hadn't heard a word of what she'd said. And so as soon as the goddamn band had softened down a bit, I had to turn to Mary and say, I'm frightfully sorry, but I didn't hear what you said. And she gave me a broad grin and said, of course. So that was that, and I was ecstatic. And we decided we had enough of Odonino's, and we went back to my digs, and we canoodled for 2 or 3 hours, and then I had to get her back to Earl's Court. And then, trying desperately to remember protocol and that sort of thing, she at the time worked as number two in the Sergeant-at-Arms office in the House of Commons. And number one was a delightful person called Mary Frampton, who was senior to her. And when, as I quite frequently did now, I rang up and the phone was answered, and Mary Frampton would always just say, Mary. And I took to saying, one or two. And we got it on a basis eventually. And then, not long afterwards, I moved very quickly. and got pilloried for it by my mother, who said that she wanted time to write to all her friends and tell her and all that stuff. And I wasn't having any. I wanted to strike while the iron was hot. And so we got an announcement in the paper and so forth. And the deputy sergeant at arms, whose name escapes me, very well known, an extremely nice man, Colonel Thorn. And he decided that if some strange man, and a naval officer at that, was chasing one of his girls, he'd better check him out. And there was at the time, just opposite the House of Commons, the other side of Bridge Street, I visited, there was, I think it was called the Tavern. There was a restaurant. And it had a very, very steep staircase going up. And it was where some MPs went and took their lunch and possibly had guests if they were going to attend the afternoon session and that sort of thing. And by arrangement, I know exactly what he was up to, he asked me to meet him there for lunch. And the day came, and it really was a steep staircase. It was almost like climbing a ladder. And as I approached the top, I was aware of a pair of well-trousered legs standing, blocking my path, as it were, from going on. And each step I took, I saw a bit more of this figure. And eventually I came just about face to face with him at a range of not much, half the distance that I am to you now, and so on. And it was just like that scene in Africa, in Rhodes' time. I was sort of saying, Colonel Thorne, I presume, and he was saying, Commander Leach.